The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A particularly disturbing detail in the report is this individual's creation of a Facebook album prior to the terror attack itself, which had a bunch of right-wing videos in it, but also had a photoshopped image of one of the ultimate targets in the terror attack on fire. It begs the question why did more red flags or the right red flags not go up?
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 5th, 2021. 2 years ago, a gunman opened fire at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, killing dozens of innocent people. And last December, the government of New Zealand issued a giant report on the subject. Yes, we're a bit late to discussing this report, but it took a while to read it, it being more than 700 pages. The other day on Lawfare, Lawfare's associate editor Jacob Schultz and Justin Sherman of the Atlantic Council wrote a lengthy piece analyzing the report's discussion of the shooter's use of the internet. It's a particularly detailed catalog of how one user of the internet used it to radicalize, to threaten people, to celebrate racist celebrities, and to marinate in the soup of nasty YouTube videos. Jacob and Justin joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about the report, to talk about the discussion of the shooter's internet use, and to talk about what it all means for content moderation and the discussion about it that we're having today. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 5th. Jacob Schultz and Justin Sherman on the New Zealand report. Jacob, get us started. The events that we're talking about today happened a while ago, and the report on which we are basing the conversation also came out a while ago. So get us started with a history of these events and why we are talking about them now.
Yeah, so the attack itself took place in March of 2019. So it was March 15th, 2019, and it was in Christchurch, New Zealand, city in New Zealand. And so in the attack itself, just quickly, 51 people were killed. It was in the shooter ran into two separate mosques in the city. And the shooter, although the attack itself was in New Zealand, the shooter is himself Australian. And, you know, there are plenty of notable things about the shooting is pretty large-scale casualties. And in addition to that, the shooter does a bunch of things that are sort of, at the time, unique. He live streams the attack. So he live streams the attack, and people note that the way that he did this, he does it, you know, almost as if it's like a first-person shooter video game. And along with the attack, he posts a long manifesto on the internet, which is sort of dripping with anti-immigrant sentiment, but then also, on the other hand, filled with very, very online internet jokes with references to particular YouTubers and using this sort of meme-y language. And, you know, this is something that we'll come back to later, but it was sort of striking at the time of the shooting how tied to right-wing internet culture this guy was in his public-facing persona. So in December of 2020, the New Zealand government releases what is a really, really long report. It's 792 pages that parses through lots of different aspects of the shooting. So they go through what they characterize as the bureaucratic failures that led to the shooting, right? So within the Kiwi state security apparatus, the various, you know, structural things that might have contributed to this being allowed to happen. And then aside from that, they also sort of focus on in ways that are really, really interesting for the purposes of what Justin and I wrote about, really granular details about the shooter's online behavior. So the types of websites he went to, the Facebook groups he interacted in, the YouTube celebrities whom he enjoyed to watch. So there's really, really a lot there in the report, right? And people have written very interesting things about what it reveals from a sort of countering violent extremism perspective and from a security perspective. But, you know, again, for Justin and my purposes, what was really striking to us was all the different components that really catalog in pretty great detail the shooter's behavior online.
So Justin, give us an overview of, first of all, of what we're not talking about today, i.e. what are the sort of major components of the report that is, you know, there if people want to go read it, not what we're focused on today, but then also why you guys bored in on this particular aspect of the report, that is the sort of very detailed cataloging of the shooter's online behaviors.
So as Jacob said, we focused pretty specifically in our piece on the technological elements of this individual's behavior, and so do not go into and are not going to be talking about the bureaucratic failure elements he mentioned, various investigative procedures and techniques that were detailed in the report. We're also not really going to talk about much of the online activity following the attack. As Jacob mentioned, one of the most significant internet entangled elements of this incident was the individual streaming the shooting at the first mosque on Facebook. But what we pulled out in the article, because I think this is not something that had been detailed much prior to the report's publication, was this individual's online activity in the lead up to this incident. So this spans everything from activities in Facebook groups that were both sharing and sort of incubating the individual's own right-wing extremism, Islamophobia, racism. This is the individual's activity on YouTube, and all kinds of interesting extremism and hate speech issues therein. But kind of the third thing I think we are going to focus on here, which we end the piece with, is what this says about internet content moderation today. Because for all of the discourse we've had in the couple of years since this terror attack actually occurred, it's amazing how many of the problems that are reflected in the report that were present in the lead up to the attack itself still continue to vex policymakers and others in that community today.
And one thing I'll add, Ben, just to what Justin said, is that part of I think the appeal of focusing on this aspect of the report is it is really pretty rare that you get this granular a look into someone after the fact, into someone's internet history, right? Like, it's not like we have a day-to-day catalog in the report of what he did, but it is a pretty rich text to look at. And I think what I at least thought was helpful and interesting about it is, right, there's lots of, you know, bigger picture studies of how people go about their life on the internet and extremism circles, but there's really very rarely the chance to look at with one specific person who did end up committing some sort of horrible atrocity, what it was that they occupied themselves with online before this. So I think it at least what stood out to me about this versus other aspects of the report is sort of the detailedness of it and the look at something that you might not otherwise get.
And when you say detailed, how detailed is it? Is this in a 750-page report? Is this 7 pages, 70 pages, 300 pages? Like, what does it really catalog?
So I couldn't tell you off the top of my head how many pages it is exactly, but it's definitely up there. And I can tell you that Jacob and I spent many, many hours reading over and rereading over various tech elements of this report. And that's because it wasn't pigeonholed to one section. There were threads throughout the entire document talking about this individual's online activity in the lead up to the terror attack. But it gets very specific, to answer your question, Ben. There are quotes from specific messages that the individual sent threatening people on Facebook who criticized his and his allied group's extremism. There were specific counts in terms of the number of comments or posts he made on Facebook. There's documentation of YouTube activity. There's record of activity on different payment processing platforms. There's pretty good detail about the individual uploading his manifesto to a couple of file sharing websites, which I'd love to circle back to. So I'll let Jacob jump in here, but I think it's pretty detailed, like he said, relative to what you would typically see sort of at a media reporting level about various anecdotes from something like this.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's quite detailed, although the one caveat I would give just in the name of not giving people misimpressions is it's not really the case that it's a comprehensive look at everything that this person did on the internet. So it's not, you know, you might imagine something where the report is effectively a copy paste job of someone's internet search history. And that's not what's going on here. It's more anecdotal in the sense that I think the people who compiled the report made some, you know, editorial decisions about particular flashpoints that they wanted to showcase and particular things that they wanted to highlight. Although they chose to highlight those things in really great detail. So you know, instead of getting something that says the individual commented on X, Y, or Z Facebook group and, you know, a paraphrase of what they commented, you'll get what amounts to, you know, 100 words of a block quote of what the person actually said in the Facebook group. So it's quite detailed, although it's not, you know, a comprehensive, all-encompassing catalog.
And so what do you take to be the main themes of it? I mean, we kind of have expected ever since Columbine that when people do mass shootings, there may be some untoward internet history and hanging out on groups and leaving sort of apocalyptic annotations of intent. And you guys in your piece describe that, but you describe a lot more than that. And so I guess my question is, what's the big takeaway from this exhaustive documentation of this guy's internet history? What's the, you know, what is at the margins, what does it teach us?
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear what Justin says, but I think from my perspective, the thing, it's maybe less what it's teaching us as in terms of like a novel contribution to the way that we think about what people are doing, and more so, at least from my perspective, confirmation of what lots of different people have been saying for a relatively long time, right? So just to take an example, YouTube is a platform that really comes off looking quite bad in this report. And there's lots of detail about the shooter rather than spending all this time commenting in right-wing forums like we might imagine, and I think is sort of more akin to the sort of Columbine style guessing at what mass shooters would do on the internet. This guy spent hours and hours and hours and hours on YouTube, right? And considered it his primary source of information. So I mention that just to say that I don't think it would be completely disingenuous for us to represent that as some sort of novel idea that YouTube is this bad place. But a lot of strains of the report give credence to things that people who study the internet really carefully have been warning about for a long time, right? So that like Facebook groups are a really bad corner of Facebook and a really dangerous component of the platform. And YouTube videos are not just this place that's, you know, separate and apart from Twitter and Facebook. It's really a main driver of people's consumption of extremist content, right? So I think from my perspective, the big takeaway from the report is less that it's breaking any new ground and showing us things that we could have never thought of before, and more that it's confirming in really interesting detail different strains of online extremism that people have either neglected or have been, you know, crying out into the wilderness about, and people have chosen not to listen. And I think it'd be interesting to get into some of those, but for me, that was the big takeaway.
I would concur with Jacob. We broke the article up, and perhaps to his point, this is a good way to speak next about some of the specifics, but we broke the article up into really, I would say, talking about Facebook, talking about YouTube, and then talking beyond those two platforms. But I agree that there isn't anything in here that's particularly novel. You know, the fact that Facebook groups, for example, can be a breeding ground for violence and extremism I don't think would be anything new to anyone, particularly after, for example, the January 6th terror attack on the Capitol and the pretty comprehensive media coverage of the ways in which Facebook groups were just one of the vectors through which some of those people organized. So all to say, I think it's right to say that one of the main takeaways is these same problems continue to exist. And so to the extent that this report is a way to dive a little bit deeper into the specific content of particular hateful posts, into the specifics of particular extremist online activity, it is a detailed case study in that way, but I don't think, you know, on the whole, it's anything entirely new.
So one thing that does seem, I would say, new-ish is the degree of engagement that this guy seems to have had with his racist heroes in various online fora. And you see this a little bit with in some terrorist incidents for a while. Every time they sort of caught somebody, that person seemed to have corresponded with Anwar al-Awlaki, right? And there was a sort of sequence of people who he seems to have been coaching or grooming or counseling. But this seems a little bit different. It seems to be initiated by the shooter, and he just kind of has this habit of reaching out to racists he admires on YouTube. I'm curious what you guys made of that pattern.
Yeah, so I think first, just to hammer home the distinction from the al-Awlaki framing, is that, you know, in the case of a lot of those jihadist attacks, there was really direct connection and direct communication between the people who would commit these attacks and, you know, al-Awlaki on the other hand. And in this case, that is not really what's happening. So just to back up a little bit, one thing that we were really struck by, and you alluded to this, is this guy is really, really attached to a few right-wing celebrities on YouTube. So there's Stefan Molyneux, Richard Spencer, and then there's this Australian person named Blake Cottrell. So the way that this person interacts with the internet is not, at least as it's presented in the report, is less that he's sort of passively consuming videos that have a similar ideological valence. It's that he is really invested in the individual personalities. So he, just to take the example of Blake Cottrell. So Blake Cottrell is someone who in Australia founded two far-right groups. He was convicted in an Australian court for live streaming a decapitation of a dummy in protest of a proposed mosque. So the shooter, the Christchurch shooter, is enthralled with Blake Cottrell, and he watches his videos. He posts in Facebook groups affiliated to this person, and he will single out people who ambiently criticize Blake Cottrell on the internet and send them pretty horrific, individualized harassment. And then he also, in something that I thought was quite interesting, and I think Justin did too, he gives money to Blake Cottrell. And it's not just Blake Cottrell that he gives this money to. He gives money to Richard Spencer and the think tank that Richard Spencer runs. And he gives money to Stefan Molyneux. And he's giving these, they're not huge donations by any stretch of the imagination, but I think what struck us and what struck people when the report came out is that there is really a degree of parasocial attachment, it seems, between the shooter and these, you could call them micro celebrities online. And I'll give credit here to, there's a researcher at Stanford, Becca Lewis, and, you know, I think this is really something that is more recently coming to light, but she did write back in 2018 a very long report basically arguing that YouTube is a perfect fit for these types of weird parasocial relationships where basically racist influencers can leverage the very long video length and the sort of faux intimacy of YouTube to develop these connections with dangerous individuals.
And is there any evidence that connects these relationships that he develops with the activity, that is the violent activity, or is it really just that he's motivated enough to develop these, as you call them, parasocial relationships? So what in retrospect about this is probative of anything other than that he was in fact a racist, which is, of course, a necessary but insufficient condition to be a racist mass shooter?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. So there's a few clues. There's not a ton in the way of direct evidence of a causal link between these parasocial relationships and the shooting itself. One thing that was interesting in the manifesto that the shooter released, he makes a joke toward PewDiePie, who's another YouTuber. So PewDiePie, not anywhere near the same territory as the people who he's giving money to, but it's a YouTuber who's quite famous and has had some controversies involving racist views. And in the manifesto itself, he makes a direct reference to PewDiePie. And not that that's necessarily probative of anything, but I think to me, it was at least illustrative of the fact that him engaging in this activity, it seems like it was hard for him to disentangle the shooting itself from his interactions and the world that he lived in on the internet. And I guess the other thing that I would say in the way of a specific connection between the shooting and the relationships that he has with these people is there is this Facebook group, and Justin can speak more to this, that is effectively dedicated to worshiping Blair Cottrell and to supporting these groups that he founded in Australia. And the shooter, there are some posts that the shooter makes in those groups that really, really push the level of you would reasonably question whether this is a person who's going to engage in mass violence, right? So there's no direct connection, but you can sort of see the way in which these relationships keep him in communities where really violent rhetoric beyond just racism that stays online is happening.
Justin, from your review of this document, is there anything in the account of him that in this sort of particularly detailed set of online interactions that you would say should have flagged him or would reasonably flag him as, you know, something more than a racist fanboy, but that this is somebody who's actually capable of real violence? In other words, you go through this process of writing a 700-page report on this, and you kind of note that the things the security forces should have done better and sort of processes that didn't work. But is there any part of this document where, you know, you kind of stop up short and you say, wow, somebody who's doing this is well outside the normal range, even the normal range for, you know, people who hang out on racist websites, and this should have been a flag to whomever?
I would say there were certainly a number of flags. Most of what I'll talk about in a second is Facebook, but I do want to highlight first that the report also mentions even the individual having an online extremist history before sort of the 2016-2017 timeframe, when it really starts documenting in detail these activities, because it references, for example, that this individual told his mother that since he was a teenager, he was using the 4chan online message board, which is notorious for, among other things, hosting hate speech. He would also play video games with people on the internet and use the chats within those games to express and talk about, you know, racist and far-right views. So this did not start by any means with or on Facebook, but as Jacob mentioned, one of the big focal points of online activity on Facebook for this individual was a group for the United Patriots Front, which is a far-right extremist group in Australia. And from 2016 into early 2017, this individual was a pretty regular commenter on this organization's page. He would praise, as Jacob said, the leader of this organization, as well as the leader of another far-right Australian group. And this was also the source of a couple of direct messaged threats to other Facebook users, which I think is a prime example of something that should have sent up red flags. I'm not going to repeat what it is, although the report has some quotes in there. But for example, there was one Australian critic of the leader of the United Patriots Front, and so he direct messaged a series of death threats to this individual.
And when you say death threats, just to be clear, there are a lot of ways to send death threats. And, you know, I've gotten dozens or hundreds of people who you know, send me notes expressing the pleasure they would feel or the hope that they have that eventually I get hanged by the neck until dead. They always specify the until dead, but they're not actually threatening to do it themselves. How explicit are these threats?
They're definitely, so they're not, I suppose, some of these directly saying something like, I'm going to kill you, but I think some of them went further than saying, I would get pleasure out of your death, because one of them was something to the effect of, you know, I would love to be the one to, you know, be putting the rope up when you're killed or something like this. So I would say that they, if not an outright threat under that definition, come closer to it than simply saying it would be great if you died.
Okay.
All to say, though, right, so that was sort of one series of activities I think that would send up flags, but another pattern that is probably familiar to most listeners is Facebook then in May 2017 removed the group for the United Patriots Front, this far-right Australian extremist group, but as soon as they did that, several individuals from there just simply went and made another one. And so this individual migrated over to that new group, and then it seems became an even more active poster, sharing right-wing content on Europe, on New Zealand, on immigration, on racist views on fertility, saying that violence is the only way to have victory, sharing links to YouTube, which I know Jacob can talk more about, videos that were later removed for breaching YouTube content agreements. So it was really a whole dearth of activity in that second group that was simply created in place of the first one that Facebook had removed because of these concerns about the kinds of content that was in there. And then the last point I'll end on, which I think is a particularly disturbing detail in the report, is this individual's creation of a Facebook album prior to the terror attack itself, which had a bunch of right-wing videos in it, but also had a photoshopped image of one of the ultimate targets in the terror attack on fire. And so there really was a whole documented series of activities on Facebook that it begs the question, why, you know, why did more red flags or the right red flags not go up?
So one thing I would say, like, it, one aspect of the report that I thought was interesting is that the authorities were pretty sanguine in the report that from a law enforcement perspective, at least in their account, there was very little that could have led them to believe that this particular person was going to do this, right? This is someone who didn't have any close friends, was financially independent, didn't have any real clear major legal violations. And coupled with that, right, a lot of the stuff that Justin is describing there, a lot of it's super objectionable, but right, as you allude to, Ben, sort of common. The one thing that I really do think is beyond the pale of just normal racist online activity is that last thing that Justin described, which is literally a foreshadowing of what happened in the attack. So it's this really direct warning of what he was going to do. And you know, hard for Facebook, I would assume, to pick that out, but that is a pretty clear indication of what was going to happen.
Right, though presumably it's only a foreshadowing in light of our subsequent knowledge that that's in fact what happened, right? I mean,
100%.
People post pictures of buildings in flames, I wouldn't say all the time, but it does happen, and it can be satire, it can be, you know, something less than a statement of intent to go shoot up that building.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, look, if you were to go back and read the stuff that the Facebook Oversight Board, the decision that the Facebook Oversight Board has been releasing about specific pieces of extremist content, you'll see the exact same sort of discussions that we're having here. Really hard to tell, you know, when something is satire, when something isn't satire. But at the same time, it's a particularly eerie set of pictures to look back on after what happened.
So is your takeaway from this, given all of that and given all of the complexity, that, hey, this is a clearly sick individual, he's a racist, you know, he may or may not be making explicit threats that he means to act on, but he's certainly making things that reasonable people would understand as threats to their lives and also threats to a building that he then, in fact, goes on to attack. So therefore, entities like Facebook and YouTube should be much more aggressive about this kind of content. Or is your view, well, hey, you know, it's really hard to figure out who's talking smack and who's being serious about this, and the amount of stuff that you would have to take down in order to actually interrupt the flow of content, since we can't know, we don't know who's serious about it and who's not. And even in retrospect, it's hard to tell the difference, that the effort is less than obviously fruitful.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious to hear what Justin thinks, and I suspect we might come down in slightly different places, but I think the report is not really a case for just throwing up your hands and saying there's nothing we can do about this. I think if you're thinking about it in the discrete sense of, was there anything that Facebook or YouTube or any other platform could have done to stem off this particular attack from happening? Really hard question to answer. I'm not really sure, but I think on a more meta level, one takeaway that I think both of us came away from this with is that there really are certain things that if Facebook, YouTube, these smaller platforms were to do on a larger scale, right, in a more probabilistic sense, you reduce the chance of things like this happening. Whether or not any particular intervention is enough to stop a particular person from doing something bad is a totally different question. But I think what was glaring, at least to me, is that there are still, you know, people have this impression that in the years since 2016 and in the years since this shooting, that platforms have, you know, cleaned up their act more and they have more rules and there's been a real revolution, you know, in the way that they approach extremist content. And yes, there are for sure more rules, more attention to these issues. But I think from my perspective, at least, the most glaring part is the report is showing you that there are places for marginal improvement that are, you know, they would be difficult to do, but it's hard to imagine how they would not make things better. Whether or not they are sufficient to stop a given individual from committing an attack, I think is a different question. But on a larger scale, these are things that I would think would be helpful to reduce the chances of these types of attacks happening.
Justin, what do you think? Is this document make the case for more aggressive content moderation or against it?
I don't know if I would put myself on either side of that sort of binary view of it. But I think so. I mean, like Jacob said, there are certain things where it's very clear that there are the same problems, right? Facebook groups is one example where Facebook obviously took down this one group because it was viewed as a problem and violating terms of service because of what was being said there. But then when virtually the same core group of individuals create an identical group, a new group right after that, and then proceed to do the same thing and no action is taken, it begs the question of why that was not being monitored. I think this, of course, is not specific to the Christchurch terror attack. We saw this, as I mentioned, with the January 6th attack on the Capitol, because immediately following the November 2020 election, there was a Stop the Steal group on Facebook that had amassed several hundred thousand members in just several hours. Facebook removed this group because of the content that was in there, but then in the ensuing weeks, hundreds of other such Stop the Steal groups, including several large ones, burgeoned, and you had, in effect, the kinds of content and discussions that they removed in the first place being replicated in all these other places. So there are cases like that where I think there needs to be a heavier hand from these platforms against hate and to stop sort of both sidesing it, but the other main takeaway I would like to highlight, I think, from this document is that we need to broaden our discussion of internet content moderation beyond the Facebooks and the YouTubes. And the reason I think this is such a significant takeaway is that most of our public discourse, and I would even argue our policy discourse, about internet content moderation, about reforms to Section 230 of the CDA, tends to focus on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, TikTok even, these large content platforms, and for good reason. But there are also a whole other range of companies across the internet ecosystem that have a role in content delivery and availability. Jenna Ruddick from American University Law and I actually have a report we've been working on that comes out soon talking about this phenomenon, but the Christchurch Commission report highlighted that this individual, as Jacob mentioned, was using platforms like PayPal to send money to extremist groups. The individual used file sharing websites to upload his manifesto prior to the attack, which was then a way for other groups to download it, and in fact is the reason that neo-Nazi groups in Eastern Europe and others still have the documents, even though they were subsequently removed. So I think that was a second big takeaway, is that yes, we should continue talking about these large platforms, but whether it's website hosts or payment providers, there are a lot of other companies in the ecosystem that have a role to play in content moderation, and we can't forget them either.
So I want to close with the hearing with the tech CEOs that happened recently in Congress. You know, this was not by and large the set of issues that people were asking about. How should we think about this report in relation to the questions that people have right now for big tech?
So I think it was an interesting coincidence of timing, at least for me, and I would imagine for Justin too. We were finishing this up the day that this big grandiose hearing was happening. And for me, I think the report is actually like an interesting way of thinking about how ineffective and waste of time this routine of dragging the same three tech CEOs up before Congress is. So for one, the person who is most conspicuously absent, and I'm channeling Evelyn Dweck, who is a relentless campaigner on this front, is the CEO of YouTube, is never, ever, ever invited to these congressional hearings. And to me, that seems like a pretty enormous oversight, particularly in light of the stuff that you see in this report, that while maybe Facebook is a problem for sure, and that's well established, there's really this neglect towards all the bad stuff that happens on YouTube. And I think that's best symbolically and probably practically represented by the types of things that you see in this report. And then the other aspect of it that I think is sort of interesting in revealing how the attention to the hearing is sort of misplaced and the energies of lawmakers might be misplaced is exactly what Justin just said, right? So there's this really narrow focus in congressional hearings on what Congress people would call big tech, right? They keep referring to big tech, big tech, big tech. And there's this conception that the internet is just composed of, you know, the same two, three, or four enormous tech platforms. And right, there's this really narrow focus on the bad stuff that's happening on Facebook, bad stuff that's happening on Twitter. And like, yes, that is important, right? But you got to keep in mind that Twitter, not the whole internet, Facebook, not the whole internet. And I think this report does a really nice job of subtly laying out how, yes, there are some really bad things involved with extremism and things that are sort of endemic on these big platforms, but there's also a whole world of different challenges that lie out there on the types of platforms that don't get called before congressional committees and that senators don't tweet about, right? There's a whole world of things that there is real opportunity for scrutiny and for reform, and it's just not happening.
Justin, final thoughts?
I think the hearing was, you know, there were many aspects of the hearing that showed an improvement from what has happened with these hearings in the last couple of years. Now, granted, that's a very low bar to clear, so that's not exactly saying much. But I do think there was a little bit less in the way of the partisan political theater about, you know, anti-conservative bias and things like this, and more actual questions about root problems.
Yeah, and people weren't asking Mark Zuckerberg for tech support.
They were asking if they knew the difference between yes or no. So we're either going forward or backward, depending on your definition of that. But as Jacob said, right, I mean, the CEO of YouTube was conspicuously absent yet again. I also wonder, as, for example, Mark Zuckerberg is getting interrogated about Instagram, why the head of Instagram also isn't separately testifying. So we can get into that. But again, the broadening the view of content moderation thing still stands. And even though there was a lot of discussion after the so-called Parler deplatforming, and I'm just going to say there were several great Lawfare podcasts about that, so you can go back and listen to that too. But for all the media attention that was given to that event after it happened, that has not come up in these hearings. The extent to which a cloud provider and web host like Amazon influences content, the extent to which payment providers can choke off funds to extremist groups and then drive them further off the internet. So again, the conversation, I think, like Jacob said, remains narrow. And while we're getting there a little bit, and I think the hearing was a little bit improved, there's still a far way to go to talking about sort of the length of problems highlighted in this report.
We're going to leave it there. Jacob, Justin, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the long-suffering Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast on all of these services that the New Zealand shooter abused. So, if you're on 4chan, no, don't go on 4chan, but pin us on Pinterest. Tweet about us, share us on Facebook, share us in Facebook groups that would otherwise have terrible content, make YouTube videos about us, and for God's sake, upvote us on Reddit. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our merch is available at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.